Hello there, this is Andrew Doyle. You're listening to Culture Wars, my podcast for Spiked. We're getting pretty close to Christmas now, so I thought I'd inject a bit of festive cheer by inviting a stand-up comedian to be my guest. And then I remembered that stand-up comedians tend to be irredeemably miserable and self-hating. But by then it was too late. So my guest this week is Scott Capuro, who is, without a doubt, one of my favourite comedians on the circuit. He's hilarious, he is genuinely subversive, and he's certainly unafraid to probe into those areas that other comedians daren't approach. So he won the prestigious Perrier Comedy Award for his first ever show at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. He's appeared in films such as Mrs. Doubtfire. He was in Star Wars Phantom Menace, where he played one side of a two-headed alien. He's been described as the most fearless and technically perfect stand-up on the circuit by The Guardian. The San Francisco Weekly described it as stand-up in the very best possible sense, deadpan, ever alert and hilarious. And then there's the Daily Mirror that said, he's evil and should be forced to leave the country. So it's safe to say he divides audiences. Let's find out why, shall we? This is Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Scott Capuro. It's occurred to me, I've never actually asked you how you started out as stand-up. For all these years I've known you, I haven't actually asked you that. So maybe I should do that. Why did you go into stand-up initially? What were you doing?
I did it in high school because we used to do a variety show in the drama department every year and they needed an MC. I was 17 and I volunteered because no one else wanted to do it. And I had to write 5 minutes into the show. It just became a sit. It went from 5 to 15 and became kind of a popular part of the show that season. And I enjoyed it. It gave me a buzz. And I was so bored and lonely, this 6'2" fucking queer boy at 17 with braces and headgear. And I lived in a rather conservative, although they didn't think they were, suburban area of San Francisco. But I felt 1,000 miles away from the queer community, even though it was about 10 minutes.
Because you say San Francisco, and I think that the hub of the queer community. I think the whole San Francisco is queer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be. You better be, or else you're out. Literally, you kicked out. But in those days, you know, this is like 1980. So I didn't have a car or access. So I am joined an improv comedy group, which is very popular in the because of Robin and having all the work he'd done on TV. And he's from this area. So some of his ex-colleagues started this improv group for kids. And I started taking it, got involved with stand-up that way, improv comedy. We did a bit of touring. And then when I went to university and took drama, they had a stand-up comedy course. I was always kind of in it a little bit, always in it.
Right, right.
And then in LA after university, I wanted to be on stage. So like these actors you meet now, I just started doing stand-up in LA. It was a big deal. And there's a lot of stage time. But I was closeted. And when I moved to San Francisco years later, about 1990, I was in a play as an actor and a lesbian comic said, there's a club you could play. I said, I don't want to do it. I was closeted. I hate it. She said, well, you don't need to be anymore. I'm like, I've never seen an out comic. You're lying. She did me do an out comedy night. This is literally 30 years ago. And I saw some out comedians on stage and I lost my mind. I lost my mind. I just started crying. I had to leave. I had to get up and go back out to my Toyota Corolla out on the street and sit there and cry.
You see, it's stuff like that that makes me find it quite difficult to believe that you weren't out.
There were no role models in LA for it. There was no one would have booked me. I would have never got Andrew. I would have never gotten on stage if I'd come out. And I was working with Rosie O'Donnell as a host in LA with Ellen, but they were all closeted. They were hosting shows that I got the luck to get up 10 minutes on stage. I was lucky to be there. They needed comics in those days because there's so much work. But if I come out, that I would have been cut. That would have been it.
It sounds like from what you're saying, you sort of almost fell into it by accident. But had you been a fan of stand-up? Had it been something that had driven you at all?
It had been popular on TV and I'd seen it. And I'd been a weird kid, a weird, funny. You know, some performers say that they had a good singing voice when they were 5 or I could tell a joke when I was 5 years old. It was creepy. I had an adult sounding voice when I was very young when I spoke, but because I spent most of my time with adults, I didn't like people my own age. So my mother and father had good senses of humor.
Right.
And I was probably trying to replicate them. And so I just would tell jokes and I would entertain the family sometimes. You know, in those days, people did that though. You put on little shows at the house, you had guests over, you had soirees. It was the '70s. My mom used to have parties where people would play board games and get up and do a thing. And I would just get up and do a thing. It got me attention because I was so insular and so shy and so queer. I didn't want to tell anyone. I was trying to hide behind something too, I'm sure.
Right. And then, so in your early stand-up acts, you were closeted. You weren't doing an openly gay act.
I didn't even think about it. I mean, I was out of my personal life, but it never occurred to me to come out on stage. Just never did. And I didn't think it as an option. In fact, it was quite dangerous to me. I was feared for my own safety.
That really surprises me when you tell me this, because I thought I thought in my naivety that San Francisco at that time would have been a very tolerant.
I was living in LA though.
Okay, and that was different.
Much more show busy LA in like 1986, 87, right out of university. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know any. There were no openly gay people in show business in the 80s because of the HIV thing. People were terrified of it. Rock Hudson had just died. If you mentioned on stage that you were queer, I'm telling you, half the room would have gotten up and walked out. It was so volatile.
So unimaginable, isn't it? It's so different.
In LA, up here though, like you said, when I moved up here in 88 and got I got my first professional acting job that year at playing a gay man in a play, a queer play. We went to DC, we unfurled the AIDS Memorial quilt on the Ellipse in front of the White House because being gay was political.
Right.
Saying you were queer was a political act on stage as well. So when I started doing comedy and saw out performers just telling jokes about their lives, I couldn't perceive what they were talking about. It felt so loud in my head. Listening to it, I had to leave the room.
Did you have an inkling, though, that that would be something you wanted to do once you'd seen that?
I went back to the club the next month when they had a gay comedy night. It wasn't a gay club, but I went back the next month and did a set. And I came out on stage, and it took me forever to say it, to a queer audience in San Francisco. I just couldn't. And I finally did, and then it's just all kind of. And when I first went to the UK in 94 to do the Fringe, Doubtfire had come out. And that gave me a lot of wiggle room on stage.
So talk me through that. So because you were studying as an actor, to be an actor, before that, weren't
my
you?
My final year was at Birmingham in the UK. At Birmingham, right. That's where I got my degree. That's why I went back in 93 to do a film, to appear at a film festival for a film I'd been in. And I did some comedy and see friends and stay with people I knew just as a thing. And then the friends I met said, you should do the Edinburgh Fringe. I didn't know what it was. I'm like, comics go up there all the time. You should bring your son up there. I met a comedy promoter. He said, because in those days it was cheap. You could bring anybody up. And yeah. I didn't have to pay for it. And I'm like, well, really? He said, yeah, just come up. And in my mind, it was a few tents and a parade. That's all I thought. That's what I'd been told it was. Right. So I showed up with my rolling luggage on the day of my opening. And it was this huge, overwhelming thing. And I was fucking terrified. And my promoter said, you know, if you don't want to do your show, you don't have to. Just do stand-up. I'm like, no, I'm going to do the show. I brought it over. I'll do it. I don't care. I had nothing at stake. I didn't give a shit.
What was the show?
A coming-of-age show about coming out on stage as a performer.
Was it a stand-up show or was it more a theater?
It had elements of stand-up in it, but it wasn't a stand-up show. But it hit a chord with people. It struck a chord with people who hadn't seen any openly gay performers doing stand-up on stage, and The Guardian embraced it, and then The Scotsman liked it. It totally snowballed. I went from a 40-seater with a coffee maker in the back, steaming milk during my punchlines, to a 250-seater upstairs that sold out, and then I won the award. And, you know, it was great fun to do that, to have a hit. Yeah. But what was really great was reaching so many more people than I ever had with a show I'd written for me.
I mean, it sounds like quite a unusual first Edinburgh experience, let me put it that way. I think most people who go to the Edinburgh Fringe, they don't get paid for a start. They sort of save up the money and they lose a lot of money to just end up in some horrible, wretched room. They're playing to, I think the average audience at the Edinburgh Fringe is 6 or 7.
Okay.
I think that's
right. Well,
the
problem was then too, it's just that the money was less. So and performers were brought up by their management oftentimes. So the management took the hit. So yeah. You might not make any money, but you really wouldn't lose a lot. Now there's so much more money at stake, and it's much more of a trade fair. In those days, it was just people trying out new sets, new jokes, seeing what would happen. August was quiet. Why not? It was fun. You hung with your friends. You smoked some weed. You stayed up late. You know, you had fun.
But I miss that about it. I miss the idea that you could go up there with a show that isn't fully ready, that you actually use the month to develop the show. Like that to me was quite great, that it was experimental, interesting. And now, like you say, the trade fair element to the Edinburgh Fringe is really prominent. The idea that you are, you know, you want to make sure your poster's in the prominent place so that the critics come in, so that the industry come in. In fact, comics particularly seem more interested in what industry are in than what the audience think, you know?
Well, I think partially, you know, this is so long ago though, but then, the internet didn't have a stronghold over the festival. So your success was really word of mouth. And this is before there were star ratings for reviews. So people now just look for 5 or 1 stars. Then you had to read the whole review. And so it made people want to see you because they read something they liked. They hadn't just seen star rating. And then also, it was really tag team. I mean, people would tell their friends, you know, all you need a decent banner with a good line from a review would sell you out then, because there was so much then too. I mean, there's 10 times now. But then there was a lot to see and people needed to be guided, you know. And I, also, there wasn't a stronghold by the three or four main venues. There was the main venues and people were aware of them, but there wasn't kind of a choke hold over critics and over where people spend their money.
I think now as well, I mean, critics in the mainstream press are pretty much redundant at the Edinburgh Fringe now. A lot of them don't even go.
It's gone back around, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's become more word of mouth again, I think, which is good.
It could be that, and it could be, you know, a lot of people, some people just review on their Twitter feed or whatever, and you can get stars that way, you know. I think a lot of punters just look at this number of star rating, number 5 stars, number 4 stars, and just judge on that. They don't know where they've come from. They don't know what they're saying.
But I also think that people do kind of, they go into forums now, you see what people are saying. I think it's word of mouth, but in a different way, because some shows I know that did well last year didn't get a lot of star ratings, even on Twitter and all that shit. They got a buzz and a build because what they were talking about was something a bit more unusual. You know, I think the Fringe is still a great tool for performers to get their word out. It's still fantastic if you're a new comic and you want to be seen not just by newspaper people, but by industry people. You want to get bookings, you want to get work, you want to get tours. It's still there for that. It's great. And it's also still great fun if you can let yourself off the hook as a performer and not have too many goals in mind.
I think that's key. Like, going up there expecting to become a big star is not the right way to do it.
It probably won't happen, but it's less likely now. But I also feel like, you know, I was glad to have been there when I was. And, you know, I remember speaking to someone who at the time was on TV all the time in the UK, who I ran into here, and he's still very well known. It's still incredibly erudite, skilled performer and one of my favorite comics to watch. But I ran into him before I went over in 1994, 95, and I asked him for his advice. And he said, you know, don't fuck off after the Fringe. Stay around. He said, because a lot of performers go over from this country.
Yeah.
And they go over a week before. They don't do the research. They get on stage thinking all the language is the same and it's not. And then if they do well, they piss off and come back to the U.S. thinking it'll all transfer and it'll be fine. They'll go back a year later. He said, just stay around.
Right.
You know, hang out after, get to know people, get a feeling for how things work. So I stayed. Yeah.
And you stayed forevermore, basically.
Well, also, I have to say, you know, the business in the 90s in the U.S., the live comedy business started to diminish a bit.
Okay.
Whereas it was blooming in the U.K. So there was a temptation of more work. I always go where the work is. It's not really, you know, I don't have feelings about, I don't feel that one place is necessarily better or worse.
So how much you spend, half the year here and half the year?
A bit more than half.
So most of the time in London, most of the time and the other time in San Francisco. Which do you prefer?
Yes, I would travel more. I like both for different reasons. I would go to Australia more often if they would have me.
Didn't you get banned from Australian TV?
I did, yeah. I got banned, yeah.
Okay, do you want to talk us through that?
it
requires some context, I think.
You know, it happens to a lot of comedians. You know, I think that we, especially if we're working on the road a lot, and I just come from a long tour to Australia, you forget the TV and live audiences are different. Comics are so arrogant. We have to be to do what we do. Huge egos, low self-esteem, and we forget that there are rules and authority figures and all that. Although, having said that, in defense of myself, I did send them a script. I was brought to perform to promote the Melbourne Comedy Festival a while back. And I just come from a yoga retreat in Maui, to be fair. So I was quite zenned out. And they flew me in, and I just done a show in Edinburgh where I caused a teeny bit of a stir because I made fun of, you know, a few sacred cows. And they wanted that show at this festival. And on the way over, I found out on the plane that I was going to do a live TV show to promote the festival as well. A spot, an interview and stand-up with this guy who was very popular. And I said to the, when I arrived and got on the ground and they picked me up at the airport, I said, are you sure you want me? Have you seen my video? Oh, no, yeah. They picked you out of just to open the festival. You're the first one on to promote it this year.
So they knew what they were getting into.
Oh, yeah. And they'd seen the show and I sent them a script. Yeah, we've seen it. We've seen all of it. And I get to the studio to rehearse. I just landed. I was so tired. You know, that was a long flight. And I got to the studio and I'm like, you know, do you want to rehearse? No, we've seen it. We know what we're getting. I said, are you sure you don't want to rehearsal? Because I'll be in my room, as you do, you know this, before you do a TV spot. You run the set 1,000 times in your head. So it's, you know, because there's so much can happen on a TV set. So many things can go wrong. You want to have the set right. So you run it. I said, I'll be in my room running it. No, we're fine. I said, what about the chat? Oh, the interview's been cut. You're just doing the set. Okay, fine. I don't care. So I get up, I do the set. People seem to enjoy it. I can see the cameraman in the back laughing, which is either a good or bad sign. I'm never quite sure. But it was not a great sign that time. And I do it. I go in the green room, watch the rest of the show. Great. Thank you. Good night. I get up the next day. Publicist picked me to a hotel to meet a radio show. And the shit hits the Australian fan. Apparently, I'd said something that was just too much. And they brought it up on the radio show. It was in the newspapers already. I didn't know what they were talking about. Oh, I had to remind myself of my set from the night before. What could I have said?
Yeah.
And apparently, the myth over years has become about me raping the Virgin Mary. I don't have any jokes about that. If I do, I'll tell them. I don't. If you have any, let me know. I'll tell them for you. What I talked about was the eroticizing of the Christ figure in Catholic school, about how he's eroticized. That's all I talked about. I never brought up the Virgin Mary. I don't give a shit about Virgin Mary.
Morning TV,
wasn't it? No. It was after the watershed. That's why I'd arrived. They took me to a cocktail party. I'd asked the station head if I could tell this joke. This is in person. And he said, oh, yeah, you're fine. It's after the watershed. Went the next day to the TV show, told the joke, and got banned from Australian TV. And now there's a term about being don't kapuro us in Australian TV. You're not going to kapuro us, are you? You're not going to say you're going to do one thing and then do something else on TV and get everyone fired. Because that's, again, the misogyny and the homophobia go hand in hand. Gay men and women are blamed for things that are out of our control.
But that is a good legacy to have.
The weird thing is I went back a few years ago and played this store in Sydney. And the comedians I met said, oh, we haven't seen you in a while. Is it because of that TV thing? I said, yeah. They said, well, we thought you means that you meant that it made you too famous to bother to come back. Because it was such a big deal.
I was just wondering whether it might be that you have a very low threshold for offense. Like that maybe you're always surprised when people actually get upset by things you say. Because some of the things I've heard you say, I can totally get why it would upset people. And I think because you're not easily offended, maybe it's that, possibly.
It could be. You know, I think I've been on the road for quite a while, since 1994 professionally. So the only thing at this point that bothers me when I watch another performer is cynicism, is the idea that they're bored on stage or that they don't have to be doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
That bothers me. That offends me. Closeted queers are our worst enemy. And on comedy stages, I see so much of it. So I'm like, okay. When I say closeted too, I also mean repressing who they actually are and being some mincy asexual journey freak who's talking about their feelings. Who gives a shit? But anyway, even that emotionally retarded response that they have to their own lives on stage, that one-dimensional, I fit in this box for you, passive sort of, oh God, Britain's full of these mincy asexual faggots that I have to watch on stage all the fucking time. That offends me. But if I'm bothered, oh, I can't always. Sometimes I'm sitting near the front row and I'm going on after them and I have to watch them and be nice. And I have this look on my face.
Yeah.
Because they're going through whatever they're going through. But if I were offended, I would leave and I would never say a word to anyone because it's my offense. What do they care what I think?
That's to do with a common feature of stand-ups, which is that they all want to be liked and they all want to be popular. And I even spoke to one of the kind of comics you're describing. Obviously, I won't mention names. And he said, you know, as soon as I say something sexual, the audience switches off. As soon as I, because they want him to be a gay best friend, like a kind of, like you say, a mincing, anodyne, you know, camp. That's what they want. That's what they expect from a gay comic, not someone who is overt about sex, which you are.
It's weird. You know, I think that they want, I don't know what an audience wants half the time, really. I just think they're all individual and they all want something different. I think they want to be entertained and amused. Sometimes they want someone that's familiar to them, a type that they can fit. And, you know, comedy has all sorts of types that are recognizable within that culture. So when you're in Britain, there are certain types that some comics will fill in America, et cetera. And I think that some people want their gay best friend, you're right, to be someone that they can mince with or shop with or whatever they are accustomed to. And that's fine. What I'm trying to do is change people's perceptions of the way gay men behave. That's what I'm trying to do. I don't think everyone should have to do that. But that's what I like to do, is to surprise them in a response.
Yes.
I think comedy should be twist and turn all the time. And I think especially in the UK, people expect that. I think that they have a pretty high standard, my experience has been at least, in the UK for comedy. I think they want something a bit different, and I try to deliver that. Some comics want to get on TV, and the best way to do that is to be as simple as possible. That's their journey. That's fine. And but that for me is a waste of stage time. I think just, you know, jump to TV, just do that. Leave stage time, because there are so many people in the UK and in America too who are desperate, you know, for give the stage time to people that really want to utilize and benefit from it.
Well, that's what you're saying about the cynicism of it. Like, I've known stand-ups, well, stand-ups in inverted commas, because they say, or the one I'm thinking of in particular, she always said to me, I don't enjoy stand-up. I don't like it. I just want to be on TV. I want to be a presenter. Mm. And my agent is making me do this. These stand-up sets. Mm. She actually said this to me, which I appreciated the honesty.
She must hate it. She must hate it. Because stand-up is hard. It's a lot of waiting. It's a lot of travel. It's a lot of low pay sometimes. Or the pay doesn't matter because the room is, the circumstances you walk into are so terrifying. But, or it can be fantastic, but it's unpredictable, which I like about it, but some people don't. So if you like predictability, especially people that want to be on TV, they want to know where their, you know, paycheck is coming from in 5 years.
Yeah. I think a lot of people on the stand-up circuit have to pander to the people in control in order to get anywhere.
They don't have to do anything. They don't have to be a comic. They can work at Tesco for the fuck I care. If they're wasting my time on stage, they can draw fucking dead. I'd love them to choke on their own tongue while they're telling that same joke that everyone else is told about airplane travel. If I have to deal one more time with someone who says to me, I don't have any political ideas backstage. They just write the jokes for me. I don't understand politics. Well, then why don't you drive a taxi? Why don't you fucking work for a butcher? No one fucking needs you up there. Why are you ruining and spoiling the set for me? Because I've got to follow your cunt and I've got to bring them back up to reality, because you have just doused them with, I don't know, some sleeping pill for the last 30 minutes, where by the time I walk on stage, they're staring at me like I'm speaking French for the first 5 minutes because they forgot what a joke was because you suck. So why don't you fuck off and stay home? Your husband makes money. Your wife makes money. Raise the kids. You're ruining comedy. You're wrecking it. Now, this is how, if you really want to know how, this isn't about the audience or about the promoter. Okay. This is about comedians, like you said, who think, I'm going to be liking, how can you do it? Isn't entertaining them enough? No. It's clearly not enough entertaining them, because a cartoon entertains them, or a song from their past, or masturbating into the mirror while they look good for 24 hours entertains them. I don't care about that. I want to change them. This should change their perception, what's going on around them. Or else, why don't we all dig our own grave?
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. We do end up doing some shoddy gigs. Do you remember when we went to Gibraltar to do that? Just to contextualize for people listening, we went to the Gibraltar Fringe. I had no idea what to expect, but we were the only two acts on the Gibraltar Fringe.
We
were the Gibraltar Fringe. Because they didn't even have a festival, so I'm not sure what it was the fringe of.
They had a stage. There was an island in a pond, remember?
Yes, I do. It was, the stage was over a pond full of tropical fish, all these kind of elaborate fish. And I remember, because when we got there, and of course, because it was in the evening, but because it's Gibraltar, the sun was out. It was bright sunshine.
When you started, it was sunny,
And we got there and there was a waterfall. I don't know if you remember this. There was a waterfall behind the stage, which was making quite a lot of noise. And I said, we'll probably have to turn that off because it's distracting. And he said, but the fish won't like it. And that was his genuine response, that the fish would be troubled by this. And I don't care if the fish are uncomfortable for an hour. You know, I don't have anything against them, but come on, we've got a show to do.
Didn't some woman bring her children and sat in the front row? Do you remember them?
There were families on the front row with children who were literally gamboling and playing games during the set. And I did my show, so I did an hour. Then there was a break and you did an hour. So I think you had the advantage of it being slightly dark. It was starting to get
a little bit. And she left with her kids after you. She took off with the
children. Well, I don't blame them. I think I probably said something to upset them. But I remember you also upset a group that day, because I remember them leaving and they were quite annoyed at something. And it wasn't just that they didn't enjoy the material, they were annoyed at something they said. And they were quite vocal about it.
And I might have told them, I didn't fly this far to babysit you, or whatever, you know. We had a good old time. We had a good old time with the submarines guys and all that. It was fun. It was like those kind of gigs. It's like, I don't care. I'm never coming back. We're never going to see each other again, any of us. So.
It was fun. It was just surreal. Yeah. Yeah. I think I also, but now that you've mentioned it, I have to contextualize that. The submarine guys. Okay. Well, we'd go out to after the first night, because we were doing two shows.
Did we do two nights?
Two nights. Yes, we did. And after the first night, we went to that bar and it was full of English submariners who had pulled in. Yeah. Uh-huh. So a nuclear submariner pulled in for the night at Gibraltar, and all these lads who'd been underwater for months.
Like 5 months together. Yeah.
Having their big night out, and we were the only non-submariners in the bar, I think. And they were outrageous. They were flirty.
They were hilarious. And they had a sense of humor. I remember they said to you, did you tell any racist jokes? And you said no. And they're like, oh, that's too bad. And then they told us some racist jokes that were so fucking, and we're like, why weren't you in the audience? You would have been great. And they had that one guy from the submarine that they made fun of because of his cultural heritage. Remember all
I
that?
Don't remember that. I don't remember that.
Yeah, they called him a certain name, and then he was there laughing about it. Oh, yeah. It was great. The whole experience was great.
I remember them telling me about how they resolve disputes, and they said they'd get together and have a fight in the basement of the submarine.
Yeah, they would beat each other up. Yeah.
I mean, this is just a world of masculinity that I can't even comprehend. I don't even know what to do with that.
Yeah, I'd love to inject in comedy clubs again. We're missing a bit of it. But also, I remember too, they were talking about their girlfriends, and you and I are like, well, we're all the women. Like, we wanted a night off. Couldn't be bothered.
That's hilarious.
After they've been in the shit together for 5 months, they want a night off from their girlfriend. The whole thing was, it was just so good. The plaques on the buildings in Gibraltar, get off my rock. Remember all that? Get off our rock.
Oh, yes. There was a political issue. These were Gibraltar separatists, were they?
Yeah.
These people who wanted
Spanish, get off our rock, all that shit.
And yet it looked like some weird provincial British town that had been plonked in the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Spencer on the high road. It was so... And shit British food. We're like, where's all the good Spanish? All we could get was like fish and chips the whole time we were there.
See, this is the joy of stand-up. When you get to go to places like this, when you do get to travel and you do get to experience different things, you know?
Yeah, and some places you never have to go back to. I never have to go back to Sheffield and watch girls wrapped in a dress too tight for them, looking like a sausage, beating the shit out of each other with bloodstains all over the front of their dresses while their boyfriends, I assume that's who they are, their bodyguards, sit on the curbside drunk, throwing up between their legs. I never have to do that again if I don't want to, ever.
But that's also part of the experience, you know? I mean, I've seen that in Newcastle, believe me. When I've played in Newcastle and I've been out on
it's
a Saturday night.
It's definitely part of it.
It is like a war zone. It's like, it's apocalyptic. In a lovely way. I mean, it's a lovely city.
Yeah, and Brighton is too, but I've had to be escorted back to my hotel in Brighton because I've pissed off a table full of lesbians so much that they've broken their beer bottles on the stage and are singing hooligan songs while I'm telling punchlines and then threatened me. So I can't do that night anymore.
It's the same in every city. It's got
all
to be.
All comics suffer it. It's not just me. It's all, you know, you might get an audience. But that, like you said, I never worry about the audience. I'm not worried about them.
No.
And they forget some of them are so drunk they forget what they said the next day anyway. I'm worried about, you know, the recriminations professionally backstage and later. That's what I concern myself with.
That's what I was saying is I think they have more power now. I mean, I remember doing a gig with you many years ago in Durham. And you might recall this because the on the front row there was a hen night, and you upset them so much.
You did a little bit. Also,
what was it? Me?
But you did also a little bit.
I don't remember. I only remember you. But maybe
there's
that's
a
me
large
just
table
blame.
Of very broad-shouldered women, right? The hen table.
Yes, and they got very upset. And they at one point someone stood up during your set and said, "If you tell another joke about." That subject.
It was Madeline McCann.
Of course it was Madeline McCann.
They were giving us a hard time and I...
But then you wouldn't shut up about Madeline McCann.
I wanted to leave the room. I wanted them out so I'd get on with the show. And so I kept on with the McCann jokes. And then a lot of them left and one woman came back in, remember? And she came up to stage and was doing this in my face. And I said, either they pull you out or I kick you in the cunt. Either way, we're going to wheel your fat ass out of this club. So fuck right off. And then they had to kind of... physically remove her. But the rest of the room had paid to see a show. It's unfair to them.
No,
you know, these
I
women
know.
Don't get to command the show. It's not up to them what happens on stage. If you don't like it, it's your hen party. Go somewhere else.
And you weren't picking on them at all. It's just they took offense. They started trouble. And then I guess, do you feel it's open season at that point? If someone has disrupted the show?
Well, it's always open season. But yeah, of course, if they try to stand between me and happiness, if they try to get in the way between me and my finish, my big payoff, then they are going to get it. And some guy in a big room recently, I walked on stage and he said, I'm going to kill you. But it was so far in the back that I couldn't see him. The room was so large. And I threatened to cut his head off. And it's like...
Okay. Now I'm beginning to understand why things escalate with you.
Well, I'm going to sever his head. But you have to take control of the room. The audience expects it, especially in the UK with heckling. Here, I think people might see heckling as something negative and they wish it would stop. In the UK, once it starts, they want to see where it goes. And they want to see you. Right. If you can handle it, they will carry you out on their shoulders cheering your name. They'll name the town after you. But if you mishandle it, you will never, ever get them back in the UK, I don't think. I think it's like fiddling with a kid. You will never get your career back. If you fiddle a kid or you fuck up the heckling, that's it. It's over for you.
Those are the two things, right?
Not in that
order. Do you ever feel threatened, though? Do you ever feel threatened on stage?
That night, I just wanted him to stop. He threatened my life twice that night. He did said it twice without any reason to say it. I barely said anything on stage yet. And I remember feeling a bit threatened, but I remember thinking, too, I had the mic, and the mic said so I'd win the argument. It was a long payoff to cutting his head off. I didn't just say I'm going to cut your head off, but I did have a thing on him.
I think there's a false sense of security with the mic. That's the problem. I mean, I remember doing that gig in Edinburgh. I must have told you when it was, I think it was my first ever Edinburgh gig where that group of drunken football guys from Sunderland came in. One of them vomited into a pint glass. They were shouting homophobic slurs at me on the stage. And I started flirting with them. My response was to pretend that I was getting off on it. And that the worse they were, the better. And they got very angry and threatening. But they eventually left. But what was I thinking in a sense? Because it was a dodgy club with no security. If they wanted to, they could
have broken your legs. Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing to stop that happening. So what is it about being on stage with a mic that makes you feel indestructible? Because it's not true.
No, it's not. It's not. But I do think if you don't take what they're saying personally, it does give you a bit of a buffer, maybe.
Yes. I don't take it personally because I feel like I'm inhabiting a role anyway when I'm doing stand-up. So I don't think it's me they're really having a go at.
Of course they don't know you, but also I don't want to ruin it for the rest of the room. So the minute I start to get preachy or like I'm behind a podium giving a lecture, the minute the audience is like, okay, what are we doing here now? I don't want them to forget what they're watching.
Yeah,
I mean, I saw Alan Carr years ago, Alan, and he had something similar to what you're describing, a room full of hooligan type men picking on him. And he reduced them to just a trembling pile of nothing by playing their game. It was so brilliant to watch. And I've seen a couple of New York comics here do that too, with some anti-Semitic remarks that they handled really well. And there's always a better way to handle it, I think. If they're attacking, my attacking won't help. So I try to kind of...
Yeah. You've got to find a way. I remember Zoe Lyons saying to me once that the most important thing is to not lose your sense of humor when you're being heckled.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought that was the best piece of advice because it is quite easy just to get pissed off, and particularly because I'm mostly annoyed by other members of the audience not being able to enjoy the show. That's what really that's why I always address it. If there's an issue in the room, if someone's talking or being disruptive, it's not so much for me. It's the fact that I feel like it's not fair on the other audience members, you know?
Well, it's like that. It's like when an actress supports the PLO and you're like, you need to fucking lighten up. Like, whatever happened, Vanessa, to your fucking sense of humor? Cause you take yourself way too seriously right now. So how about talking about your work? Cause when you do that, you lighten up. And your eyes get bright.
There's a lot of that happening now, though, isn't there? I mean, celebrities are becoming very politicized, aren't they? Not knowing all that much about stuff, but
it's important to use your position to make the world a better place. I believe in that. But the best way to use your position is to make a good movie.
They can't do that at the moment, to be fair. So what else are they going to do?
No, but they're filming again. They are filming in LA again as well. Yeah, and I know in Britain they are too. And I think it's great when comedians get on camera and tell jokes about what's going on around them. Jokes, not stories, or your perceptions, or the way it's affecting you, and the way you only had 60 minutes for your yoga practice that morning because you were educating yourself online about world hunger. It's like, you know what? Tell a joke about it. You're not an activist. You're not.
See, I feel like a bit hypocrite here, but I'm not. Insofar as I do sort of political commentary and stuff like that.
Yeah, of course, but you write jokes about it.
But I do. I keep them separate. Like I do consider that like a separate thing than when I'm doing stand up. And if I'm doing stand up, I'll tell a joke about it rather than give a lecture about it. You know, I think I'm not being too much of a hypocrite.
But
there.
If you're on Sky News, you're doing so. That's not. You're not a stand up. Then you're doing something else.
Yeah, they don't want me there
telling
to tell
a joke.
Jokes.
No. Well, they wouldn't use you then if you did that. That's not what you're doing.
All right. Well, that's my defense anyway. So what have you been doing during lockdown? How have you been, you know, obviously you haven't been able to work, have you? Really?
Well, I was working in the UK a bit and then a lockdown again. Then we left, came to the US. Now I'm in San Francisco. And guess what they did? They locked down. So I have a show here on Saturday. We'll see if it happens. We don't know. And then it's the holidays and I have to handle my family. I'm going to Brazil to meet up with my husband in January. Then when I come back by then, the lockdown here will be over. I have a bunch of shows booked in the Bay Area in California. We'll see if they happen. Then I'm back in the UK, February, March, April, May. I've got a lot of shows booked there, but I've had to cancel. So I had such a great year booked because in January, February, I did a bunch of promotion, both in the UK and then in Germany, Norway and Sweden for a future tour.
Yes.
That we had spent about 12 months getting ready for and it all got pulled. I had a really great year of travel. Anyway, so we're going to try to revisit that, see if we can reproduce that. It's been incredibly frustrating. Not, of course, for everyone. I'm not taking any of it personally. It's been really, really frustrating for everybody.
Oh, of course. But I noticed that you've been doing gigs. Like you've been doing something that I would never do, which is you've been doing Zoom gigs or at least, or are they Instagram? Maybe they're through Instagram.
Both, yeah.
But I'm terrified of that because I depend on the audience response. I'm too insecure to be able to do that. I think, how has it been to do that?
Well, the
way?
Zoom gigs, like the one Sarah Millican produces out of her, I think it's from a studio in her home. It's fantastic. She and Gary, her partner, produce a show every Wednesday, a new material night. It's so much fun. And she has a front row. So there's about, I think about 30 or 35 people watching the show involved, an audience. You can hear their response. You can see them on screen. So that feels like as close as you're going to get to a live show.
Yeah, but people at home aren't going to laugh if they're by themselves, are they? If you're just sitting in a room
they
by
do.
Yourself watching it coming.
They do. Yeah, it's great. Okay. I know. I think they really enjoy it. In fact, I'm a bit nervous that some audiences are going to start preferring that because they can stay home, drink for free, and then they don't have to drive. I think they really enjoy it. She gets a great crowd. So there's that. And then the IGTV thing can be a bit daunting because that's just to my – I'm on IGTV every night when I'm here.
I don't know what that is. What's that?
Oh, Instagram television. It's just Instagram, and they have a TV app that people can watch a longer set on, more than 60 seconds, which is the average length of an Instagram video. So it's Edson filming me. We bought lighting. We bought a sound system. We do it out of the living room. People log in and they follow you and they want to play and they say stuff, but they can't necessarily join in on camera. They can, but we don't let them. But it's my husband's face staring back at me. And sometimes that can be because he'll be like,
if he looks bored, because he's quite open about his feedback.
Well, he watches a lot of stand-up. He is. And he sees a lot of stand-up at the club he works at in London. So he's been seeing stand-up for 5 years now. So he knows what he likes.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll be like, cut or move on, boring. So then that's my only audience.
It's like having a really harsh director during the performance.
But it saved us because we were here in California in March when it all kicked off. And we were stuck here until August, not planning to be here, but we were.
Yeah.
So we did that every night all summer. And people were very generous in terms of tipping. It was great. It really helped. And also gave us, you know, a structure to our day each day. And I was writing jokes all summer and doing shows on Saturdays. It was really actually quite fun. I didn't know what, you know, self-quarantining or identifying yourself on IGT. I didn't know what any of it meant. So I learned it. And now when we came back 2 weeks ago to California, we just started doing it again. And we picked up where we left off and people were watching us again and tipping us again. And it's great fun. And I think people appreciate it. I think a lot of people said to us, you make our night. Thank God you've come back. We're so glad to have you. You know, it's kind of sweet.
Yeah.
And especially during the holidays now in California, they've locked down almost the whole state. People are going to be trapped in their homes without their families around. It's quite gloomy.
Yeah. You know? I can see that. I mean, even, you know, the night that I run in London, we did a gig last night, but of course it was a socially distanced gig. And when we did these gigs, I was worried that Because you know what it's like. If there's too much breathing space in the room, if tables are too far apart, you don't get that contagious laughter.
And people start talking to themselves because they feel like they're in their own little bubble, right?
And it's harder for MCs because they don't, because people feel more exposed. So when they talk to them, there's a sense of nervousness about it. I mean, luckily we have really great MCs at the club who can handle that and have had to develop their skills on that basis.
And your room, because they have so many cabaret tables and it's such a large room, I've done it socially distanced and it felt, from an audience perspective, at least, it felt like a normal comedy room. It didn't feel, it didn't feel that far apart. It felt great, actually. I like that, that room a lot.
Yeah. And they were, you know, wanting to enjoy themselves. You know, they hadn't, in a sense, there was slightly less of the potential judgment that some audiences have. You know, they weren't going there with arms folded. Come on, make us laugh. It was more like there was a spirit behind it, which was quite positive.
I found that about Sarah's show, actually. Do I was quite foul on her new material night. And I found that they were really up for it. And I think people, maybe the audience will narrow down a bit after all this. And when people do start going out again, it's because they really want to see stand-up vocally, not just because they're on a date or they win the tickets. I think what's going to happen is the herd is going to be weeded in terms of performers and rooms. I think it's going to narrow down a bit. And then may go back to a thriving audience that wants to be a part of a stand-up show, which would be great.
So you actually see a positive aspect to this virus, which is a kind of, in comedy terms, which is the cultivation of a more comedy literate audience, maybe.
Well, also we had a weak winter last year and those dead people should have died anyway. We got to reduce the population a bit. So
what
there's
a lovely sentiment. That's so sweet.
Well, we're just catching, it's really just catching up, but also it's dusting out the old cupboards, as my grandmother used to say. But also, you know, I think also, yeah, I think people that do go back to live performance are going to go back to it. Because they want to be there. I think some people won't go back because they'll still be afraid until they're vaccinated. And the vaccines might not reach most of the population, at least in the US, until next summer. So people that do go to comedy clubs, if they do, when I'm back here from Brazil with my husband in January, February in California, we will be doing shows before we come back to the UK. And that audience will be there because they have to be there. Because they gotta have it.
Those will be socially distant shows, won't they? Presumably.
They still will be. I really think California won't get the vaccine because of Trump's fuck up until June. That's fine. I mean, the mass population, you know, they want to do 100 million doses in the state, but that won't happen until the summer.
Oh, I thought they were rolling it out right at the start of the year, though.
They will be, but I think they won't have enough access and doses until probably late spring. In the US.
Okay. But the gigs are financially viable, though, even though there's fewer audience members. It's
workable. If I sell 30 or 40 tickets, it's financially viable to me. It is because the way I do it here, people are pretty generous. We get all the money. It's fine, you know. I want to do it. And I want to be there with an audience that wants to be there. And that may be a bit of a thrill, more exciting in a way, you know.
Yeah.
But I just want to get back to not having to tell COVID jokes.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
But in a sense, the lockdown's been good because, like you say, you've developed a lot of material. So aren't you tempted to sort of put that all into a show and sort of round all this off with a show?
I hope to. Yeah, I really hope to.
Do you think you'll come back to the Edinburgh Fringe?
Well, my father outed a relative to me.
Oh, yes. Tell me about this. This was what your show was going to be at the Fringe, wasn't it?
Yeah. My second cousin, my grandfather's cousin, was a Broadway star in the 1940s and 50s named Alfred Drake. And his last name was, in real life, was Kapurow. But he moved to New York, became a Rodgers and Hammerstein leading man. So he introduced all the songs from Oklahoma and Kismet on Broadway.
Yeah.
So I'm strange, dear, but true, dear, when I look at you, dear. All these corny, you know, beautiful, if you like that.
Sounds great.
Stuff. Yeah. And I have an album cover in my hip hop closet right now with his name on the front. Big effort. And I grew up knowing about him. I guess I met him when I was tiny, but I never really knew him. And when I went to New York the first time, I called him. He thought I was my dad because he was a bit demented, old, and talked to me like I was my father and revealed all these things I hadn't known about my parents' marriage to me in questions. Like, is Donna, my mother, is your wife still singing? And as my father, poses my father on a public phone to my second cousin, Alfred Drake, who's about five blocks away from me in New York, but I didn't want to go by his house because I was afraid if he saw me, he'd freak him out because he'd know I wasn't my dad.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean? What do you mean, Al? What do you mean? And he said, is Donna still, she has such a lovely voice. And I never knew my mom was a singer. I knew she had a nice voice if I'd hear her in the background, in the
shower.
But
she was professionally doing it. Oh, she was.
She wanted to, but my father took away her record player.
Okay. So he didn't want her to become a singer.
He didn't want her singing.
Why?
And when I said to him in the garage when he outed Alfred Drake to me as being queer, and I said, oh, yeah, I spoke to him. He asked me about mom's singing voice. Oh, yeah, I took her phone. He called it a phonograph because it was so long ago. I took her phonograph away from her. I said, why, Dad? My mom's been dead, by the way, for 10 years. Couldn't defend herself. Why, Dad? He said, it's just all that noise.
Wow.
My father's not a kind person, I would say. And just last week at his house, he wrote me a birthday check, begrudgingly, because my birthday's in tomorrow. And as he's writing it, he said, this is why I never have any fucking money. That's what I hear. He's rich.
That's your birthday present.
Yeah, it's my fault. $250 wow. check is going to ruin him. So he said, he said, and he didn't say that he took her phonograph away, like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Or you might not like what I'm about to say to you. Because my father doesn't see how his behavior affects other people because he's a sociopath. So my mom, I see why she had to leave him, not so she could sing, but so she could be a person. But that my second cousin would be more interested in my mother's creative output. My father never would have mentioned that to me otherwise. What he did want to tell me was Alfred Drake was queer. I said, oh, Dad, you didn't tell me that. Oh, well, what? Would that have mattered to you? Again, sociopath. Would that have mattered to you?
So it's in your family, not the queerness.
You mean being an out gay performer for 30 years?
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. That the show business bug is in your family, right? So it's clearly there. It's
Tony Winter. And the idea that someone could do well and be queer in business, yeah, that would have made a difference to me. Well, you've done it all on your own. Not really, Dad. I haven't. If I did it all on my own, I'd be, you know, I would have killed people by now. I do it with an audience. My husband helps. My friends are supportive. Supportive, Dad, you know. So this is where the show comes out of. It was just, you know, people always think comics
What would the show be? What would it be about?
People think comics are angry. Maybe they are. But what comics try to do, good ones, I think, is take that and find out how the responsibility lies in themselves and how they can turn that into something more important than killing people in a park. What you want to do is take it and you want to make it beneficial.
Yeah. So that will be your next show then, rather than a lockdown.
Yeah.
Show.
But also, you know, how it was important for me, you know, because I was an actor early on. It would have been good for me to have known that about him.
You do tend to reflect. I mean, I remember I've seen your show about your mother's death.
Yeah.
For instance, you do have a tendency to reflect on very personal things in, particularly in your hour long shows, because I think
it's got to be personal, I think, because otherwise I get too lectury. And I think people stop. If it's not personal, I think that's when people can get offended. And that's when I find I can't defend it.
So you think it's got to be authentic?
Yeah. Otherwise, for me, as a as the way I perform. Otherwise, it sounds like I'm picking on people because I can get very snippy and dismissive.
But is there anything that you won't, anything too personal to you that you won't share on stage?
Intimate details of my marriage.
Okay.
My husband doesn't like it.
Because I've noticed when you talk about your marriage, it is a fictional marriage you're describing. You describe a fictional husband.
Less fictional now because I stopped talking about, I talk more accurately about his ethnicity.
Yes, you used to say he was black.
I did. And I don't do that anymore. I talk about my marriage a little bit now, but only lighthearted stuff. I'm not going to delve. He doesn't want it.
Did you talk about your husband as black as a way to talk about race legitimately?
Yes.
Was that like,
yes.
Okay. Because that I do often feel, I mean, you talk about being gay on stage, and that's fine because you joke about the gay community or whatever because you are gay. Mm. But if you introduce a kind of connection to race like that, that gives you license, does it? Is that the idea?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. In fact, a club owner in London just said that to me. I was there in November or September. I was doing a show there, and there were some guys in the front row that I labeled terrorists. And I got them back, but it kind of pissed the audience off for a second. And the club owner said to me, that's because you didn't say your husband was black. If you said that, you could have gotten away with that. And I'm like, that is the most racist thing I've ever heard in my life, but you're probably right. If I identified myself as being married to a black guy and then labeled somebody in the front row a terrorist, the audience might have been more likely to go along with that.
Isn't that strange?
Than knowing that it's so odd. But it's so fun to play with this stuff. And this is the part of comedy I really like. Finding out how to get away with something. How to make it palatable for an audience that is precious. And the more precious they are, the more, I think, the more clever and more strategic a comic has to be. And it really keeps us on our toes. I really enjoy it.
Well, in that case, isn't the sort of explosion of the social justice movement and all of this stuff quite a good thing for you?
Because it's great. It's a great tool for comedians.
It's easier to offend people now. I've noticed that.
But you have to be smarter to offend them, though, and keep them in their seats. Look, I worked at Burna Manning a couple of times on TV. It was all right. I don't care. It was fine. Not my cup of tea. I don't think I really would have enjoyed it. I don't think watching him would have offended me. I think I would have been a bit bored. I've seen his sets recorded. It had nothing in it for me. But it was very from a very specific backdrop and background.
Yes.
But were something like that to happen on stage now, you'd have to be a lot smarter and a lot more strategic in your game to play it. I think there are comics that do. I think comics that don't anymore that have become famous that way by pushing boundaries that are now love children. I think they've lost their strategy and they've gotten to a point where they don't have to be that smart anymore.
Well, I think the difference, though, Bernard Manning wasn't trying to be subversive against the establishment. I think he was reinforcing an establishment view at the time, perhaps.
I think he was trying to be funny from his background.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. And I think also people in show business at that time in UK, or so I've been told this in the UK, had even into the 90s when I started coming over, had a certain disdain for working class performers.
Yeah.
So he would have had that against him too. But either way, I think, I just think there's a way to do it.
You have been described as the gay Bernard Manning. I saw that somewhere. They're just misinterpreting what you're doing.
And I wear that mantle with pride. Look, they said something like, he's Julian Clary with barbs. And Julian said through a friend, who is that guy? So I love that suddenly Julian had to know who I was. I mean, you know, part of the thing that I had to overcome when I first came over in the UK was critics going on about my appearance on stage, spending like two paragraphs talking about how I looked. And they felt they could objectify me because I'm queer. And they talk about my pressed T-shirt and my California tan and all this shit. And they'd avoid my act. And to me, it's like when I've had black female comedians in the UK tell me when they were at meetings at Channel 4 and the BBC, the producers looked at them here, not here, because they couldn't look at them in the eye because they don't know what it's like to talk to a powerful black woman or a black person at all. So these people don't know what it's like to review an out queer comedian on stage. They don't know what they're hearing. When you meet men in show business who are still closeted, you think it's not that they hate sucking cock. They just... To them, a gay man's a loser, and they can't be a loser because they went to Oxbridge. They came up to the ranks. They're the winner of their family. How can they be gay? They can have sex with men, but they're never going to say they're gay because that's what losers do.
But don't you think things have got a lot better on that?
No.
I mean, you don't? Really?
No.
That surprises me.
Not at higher echelons of power. No. When the head of the BBC, the one that just took it over, who said he doesn't want people who work for the BBC going on gay pride events in Manchester. He's restricted them. This just happened. Because still, to that man, that authority figure, being gay is political. To that sad, whatever he is, that...
Wait, what's the story? I'm not familiar with this. So what's he saying?
He put a memorandum out to the staff of the BBC, especially up in Manchester, don't go on gay pride events, marches. I don't want you out there. And I don't want you Twittering about it. Because that looks political, like you're taking the point of view.
Isn't the point there that because of BBC impartiality?
They're not BBC impartial, employees, but yes, that's what he's trying to promote.
Yeah, that they can't be seen to be impartial. But
because saying the gay pride event is fun is a political move, because being queer and out at a social function is political. It's still the same.
Well, you're saying that. I mean, a lot of the people who I know who go to Pride do think it's political, think it's a political statement.
But a lot of them don't. A lot of them are heterosexual. They're there with their kids. You can't guess at people's intention for getting a gay pride. You can't tell people, I know why you're doing what you're doing, because what you're doing is political. That's what he's doing. He's being a power of authority, telling people that you don't get to be who you are. Keep it quiet. It's better.
I don't even think pride is about being gay anymore. When I walk through it recently, because I don't like being there, when I walk through it, it's mostly heterosexuals anyway. It's mostly families. It's a big party. It's just people who want to have a big party, because I don't like big crowds. I don't like it anyway. But it's corporate anyway. The whole thing just strikes me as a big corporate mess now. It's just people selling stuff, putting a rainbow flag on something to sell it.
But to say, as someone's boss, I know why you do what you do, and what you do, I'm telling you, is wrong. That's authoritative behavior.
I am skeptical about that. You know, I think this is where you and I differ. Like, I think the overemphasis on identity, the LGBTQIA stuff, just annoys me. Like, I don't like it. I think it divides us up personally.
And at the same time, we've talked about this before, you have also benefited from it. And the idea that you are who you are now, both professionally and personally, has to do with the work that community did over the past 50 years in the UK. So it's fine.
That's part of my point, is that I think there's a sense in which people don't recognize the actual sacrifices that people made a long time ago under that banner. Oh, that's where identity politics is useful, I think, where people get together and they use it to address an actual injustice. I think once you've got equal rights, but you're behaving as though nothing's been achieved, that I don't think is helpful.
I agree with you too. I hate identity politics. I hate the idea that when people see someone like a gay man on stage, for instance, that they expect us to behave politically a certain way. Although, again, it's a fun tool to play with as a comedian, because you can kind of twist and turn them.
I suppose that's what I mean, is that, you know, I was speaking to a gay conservative in America recently, black gay conservative, and he was saying that the expectation that you must vote a certain way because of your ethnicity or your sexuality actually annoys him. Mm. He actually finds that demeaning. He finds it homophobic and racist.
It is. And it's the reason why Trump shouldn't be perceived by the Democratic Party in this country as homophobic and racist. And I wish they see him as a gift, which is another thing my new show's about. Because he's a jewel wrapped in velvet handed to the Democrats. Handed to any political person who's in a position of leadership right now.
Well, sure, because Biden's campaign was basically not being Trump.
In reaction to him. But also, I think Trump showed us that there are some problems in the political system in this country, and that people are not represented, and that there are a lot of people who vote for president in this country who don't apply themselves to either political party or any specific political movement. I'm sorry, because someone is Latino or African-American, and you can't expect them to vote Democrat and be loyal. That's so racist to be loyal to you. Why? Because you haven't represented them at all in any direct or indirect way for the last 20 years. A lot of black people in this country waited for things to change under Obama, and they saw it get worse. So why should they vote for another Democrat? They don't see Hillary as running a good campaign even, or saving them. She's not a savior. Who the fuck does she think she is? They're not going to save anybody. They're in it for their own high. They know this. So at least with Trump, they feel like, well, at least he's funny, or at least he appoints someone locally that I can trust. I don't know what they think.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because after the vote, when it turned out that so many Latinos had gone to Trump, had voted Trump. Yeah. And the reaction was pretty amazing. I mean, obviously, I'm gauging this on Twitter, which you never should. But there were academics. I remember one academic talking about how we need to have a conversation about how Latinos are really white. They're a brand of whiteness. They're white adjacent. In other words, they couldn't be Latino anymore. They couldn't be an ethnic minority anymore because they'd voted, because politically they were something. And I couldn't help but think, this is racism.
You know, it is. And if you voted for Trump 4 years ago, especially if you're not an aging white man, if you voted for Trump, it's probably because your life is going great necessarily.
Right.
It might be because things aren't working out for you and you've been ignored. And there is no safety net, which somehow politicians during campaign times in this country seem to forget. That there's no, you know, people here in California, their unemployment ended in July. I don't know how my friends here are surviving without any work. Yeah. And in August, the Senate staff went on recess as people are losing their homes and starving to death. And they're still in conversation. They still have not come up with a plan. So there's that. Or, you know, when Trump won, a TV network in the UK sent me to Washington, D.C. to interview people about why that happened.
Yeah.
The first people I interviewed were the staff at the hotel I was staying in. There was a foreign-born American black man and an African-American female working on the front desk. So I said to them, do you mind if I ask them? Like, oh, yeah, we both voted for Trump. We both did. And I said, why? They said, well, we want the wall. We really want that wall. And I said, really, the wall? Yeah, he's going to finish the wall. He's going to build the wall. Okay. And if you remember, that was a big promise Trump made during his campaign.
I do remember, yes.
And I said, well, what about the wall interests you? They said, well, so many coming in. We got to keep them out. You know, we want our jobs. And off camera, the woman who I became friends with that weekend, you know, acquaintances, told me, she said, I'm just worried that, you know, those people will come here and work for less and they'll take my job away. She said, I've got kids.
Okay. So it wasn't coming from a kind of, it wasn't an I hate Mexicans thing.
No, it's a desperation thing. She's desperate. She's been made desperate. She's been reminded how desperate she should be all the time, because in this country, Latinx women with children and single or divorced and African-American females on their own are on the lowest pay scale. Yes. So what are they going to do? They've been told, oh, the hordes are coming in. They're going to, of course, they're working 50-hour week.
Yeah, but even what you've just said, I mean, Latinos overwhelmingly don't describe themselves as Latinx. This is something that's been imposed on them by these sort of white liberal posh people.
But you know how they do describe themselves here, and both those people do, this middle class. And that's because in this country, there is no working class. There is no lower income. Well, they don't exist.
Yeah. Well, there's poverty.
No. If you say you live in poverty, that's like saying that you're a Martian or you speak French. You're a freak. No, you are middle. You have a job, don't you? You have a place to live. You're middle class. Working class or poverty are the homeless living in tents, and no one talks about them. They're complete. Listen, if I go for a run in San Francisco, I run through people's living rooms. I'm not kidding you, Andrew. I run through people's living rooms. All I turn in, you know, and they're not just a tent or a sleeping bag. They have built a home on the street. They're cooking food.
I've seen it. I was pretty shocked, actually. It was when I was in LA.
Yeah, and that's poverty.
You turn a corner and you were like, I've just gone from the most opulent road into a shantytown. Do we still say shantytown? I don't know if that's right.
I know what you mean, but it's true. And that's what poor people, that's what working class, that's poor. If you have a job and you have kids and you live in an apartment in DC, you're middle class. The British get middle class more accurately, although they're shy about it. But in Britain, middle class means, you know, you have university education, you have 6 weeks off a year, you've traveled all over the world, you've got kids, you have a nice house, you live in Highgate. That's middle class. Because the British would never, ever identify themselves as upper class. That's for other people to say about them, really.
Right.
They would never do that. But here, people will tell you if they're upper middle class, they will tell you right away. They will.
That's because it's an aspirational country. That's it. Yeah. A lot of people vote a certain way because they feel that the American dream can happen. Like, it's a bit of a cliche, but I think it is still at the heart of everything, isn't it? The idea that we can achieve.
And I'm sure this woman was voting for Trump in her mind with her kids in D.C. because she was doing it for her children. In some way, she'd worked it out in her head that she wanted her kids to do better than she had. And that to achieve that, Trump had to be in office.
So we're running out of time. I just want to ask, are you hopeful then for the future now that Biden's coming in? And I know that you would describe yourself as supporting the Democrats. Because it feels like this year has been a pretty crazy, out of control year. It feels like it's been freewheeling. You know, I mean, army on the streets, that's pretty bad.
That's bad.
Do you think that things will settle down?
Unidentified soldiers on the streets with no name tag on them and no one knowing what rank they are or where they're from.
That's not good. That's not
malicious. We have malicious on the streets.
Do you feel that, because I get the sense as well that even a lot of Republican supporters just wanted Trump out because they sensed that this would calm things down, that actually he's not the best candidate to de-escalate tension. Is that an understatement?
I would say that's accurate. I would also say, though, that he's an easy target for both Democrats and Republicans. I don't see them criticizing him now. And there are still, like, the state of Texas is suing the U.S. government to keep Trump in office. That's happening right now. The attorney general from Texas is putting a case before the Supreme Court. So it's still a problem. They're going to use Trump as much as they can, as much as they did for 4 years, to redirect people's attention. I think the problem actually is, and it might not go away, that we live in an economy that is moving quickly and that doesn't support or represent huge, massive people who still think of the economy as the way it was 30 or 40, 50 years ago when their father was in a union or their mother made a living on her own in a department. You know what I mean? It's like people need to be retrained, reeducated. They need new skill sets. And we need the tax system to represent the way the economy is now. So those are the problems. We need a federal basic payment hourly wage. We need healthcare that reaches everyone in this country. And these problems may not be solved by who's ever in office. So I'm worried that if they don't get solved, that there may be some sort of mass revolution. I don't know.
But do you think the political tribalism? Because Biden is now saying he wants unity. He wants to listen to what Republican voters have
to
say.
He's so old. He broke his foot playing with his dog. I don't know.
Yeah.
He's appointing people that were in office under Trump.
So what are you suggesting? That it's more of the same? You think it's more of the same with Biden?
We're all worried about that, aren't we? We are, yeah.
Well, that's a nice positive note to end on.
But we've got a constitution. That's the reason Trump's going. And, you know, the American economy will always do better than everybody else's because we're whores. So for now, you know, at least we don't build buildings to launder money like the British do. That's going out of style. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Scott, thanks very much. This has been fun.
Good to see you. Take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too. You've been listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and Scott Capurro. If you enjoyed the show, please make sure that you like and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you fancy it, why not check out some of my articles at www.spiked-online.com. So, enjoy Christmas, stuff yourselves with poultry, gorge on liqueur chocolates, and drink Prosecco till you vomit. It's what Jesus would have wanted. Bye-bye.